Thank you. fear and hatred. And that necessarily means that it is something at which the Republicans are past masters at of any other preposition that you want to hang on the dangling end of that ill-constructed sentence of mine. It's 8 minutes past the hour, and I just realized that I wasn't sending, but I need a producer. Oh, maybe after the kids are all grown up and gone to college, Agnes will come back here and produce me some more. That, or not. I don't know. Sorry about that, but we're here. Yeah, Susan. News Ninja Susan. Nice music, Bob. You are aware that you're broadcasting classical music, I hope. Well, no, I wasn't at the time because I'm a little bit, atne, ute, itbre, in the ed hay, if you one what I in me, right? Jeebus. Wrong button. So, yeah, I'm here. I forgot to run. Forgot to push the button. But no, we do have, we've got several thorns in the side to deal with. And I'm of the inclination to begin with a thorn in the side by the name of Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist. Remember that Blazing Saddles clip from last night? No, not like that. How about Decamp Town Ladies? Or Swing Low Sweet Chariot, right? Well, poor put upon aqua Buddhist Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, has finally figured out what it is that it would actually mean to America if everybody in America got to go to the doctor when they needed to go to the doctor. Yeah, he did. You're not going to be okay with this. Don't reckon. Well, let's just go to Rand Paul, his own self, and get this out of the way and over with.
In regard to the idea of whether or not you have a right to health care, you have to realize what that implies. It's not an abstraction. I'm a physician. That means you have a right to come to my house and conscript me. It means you believe in slavery. It means that you're going to enslave not only me, but the janitor at my hospital, the person who cleans my office, the assistants who work in my office, the nurses. If you have a right to their services, basically once you imply a belief in a right to someone's services, do you have a right to plumbing? Do you have a right to water? Do you have a right to food? You're basically saying that you believe in slavery. You're saying you believe in taking and extracting from another person. Our founding documents were very clear about this. You have a right to pursue happiness, but there's no guarantee of physical comfort. There's no guarantee of concrete items. In order to give something concrete or someone's service, you got to take it from someone. So there's an implied threat of force. If I'm a physician in your community and you say you have a right to health care, do you have a right to beat down my door with the police, escort me away, and force me to take care of you? That's ultimately what the right to free health care would be. If you believe in a right to health care, you're believing in basically the use of force to conscript someone to do your bidding.
Yep, you heard it right. He really said it. If you believe in universal health care, you believe in slavery. Paying a doctor under a government plan hundreds of thousands of dollars per year for treating any and all people who come to his office is the same as putting irons on his hands and his wrists and his legs and marching him off into the cotton field to chop cotton and sing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. This guy makes me nuts. This, the presence, bless his heart, Corey dropped me a note via Facebook. There's another thorn in my side, Facebook. Corey dropped me a note via Facebook saying, Bob, please talk about this tonight. This is the best, this is yet another argument for why Louisville should secede from Kentucky. And it's another one of those moments of, well, you know, it's like the Rand Paul sign that I saw in the well-manicured yard in Kentucky a year or so ago. I was so curious, I just wanted to go knock on the door and say, I just want to look at you. I just wanted to see if you had three heads or a head at all, or were you just operating on pure reptilian brainstem impulse, because you're going to be a Rand Paul voter. And oh, my God. This is the man who inspired the Kentucky curb stomper. This is one of the leading lights of libertarianism. Conscription. Did you hear that? Conscription? Universal health care is conscription. You know, the government's going to come and knock on his door at 3 o'clock in the morning. Get your scrubs on, Rand Paul libertarian ophthalmologist. You're coming with us at bayonet point to go and ask somebody sitting in a chair, is it better this way or this way? This way or this way? This way or this way? Now, get a move on, Rand Paul libertarian ophthalmologist, or we'll plug you clean through. We're conscripting you for the socialist health care army, and we're taking your little janitor, too. That just make your eyes cross? I mean, is that just... I read that yesterday. You know, he said this in an actual governmental setting. It was a Senate Health, Education, and Labor Committee hearing. And this was the question of whether or not access to health care in an industrialized nation is a human right. Now, what he doesn't address is the other side of that coin. If it's not a human right, then the answer is, can't afford the doctor? Screw you. This is a libertarian universe. Go die, you poor, sad bastard, you. Because life is not a human right. Human life is not a human right. That takes just a little getting around. By God. But it goes kind of hand in glove with an AP story from 2 days ago, Tuesday. We already have a massive problem with uninsured people in the United States. It's tragic, and it is whether the... Well, they don't have any shame, so really, what are you going to say? The national health care uninsured crisis is, to my way of thinking, a national shame. It is something that should make us hang our heads in shame. And that's the crisis as it presently exists, mind you. Well, as of the AP article written by Ricardo Alonso Zaldivar on Tuesday, May the 10th, the budget as proposed by the Republicans in the House of Representatives would add another 44 million more low-income people to the list of the uninsured. The reason that would happen is because over the next 10 years, the federal government would cut contributions to states' Medicaid funding by about 33%. This is based on an analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Urban Institute. Now, I don't... If you think about Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist's previous statements, it's not hard to see why he would say that universal health care is the same as putting a bayonet in the back of a doctor and compelling him into slavery. Because you must remember that Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, also said that public accommodation laws that guarantee that guarantee access of people to lunch counters and such. Well, those were wrong, according to Rand Paul. A business owner has a right to refuse service to anyone he chooses, and the free market will take care of it if he's a racist. Because the free market that took care of gosh, if it hadn't been for the lunch counter sit-ins, Walgreens would have gone. It would have just gone away eventually. And yet this is the same Rand Paul. This is the same Rand Paul who has taken thousands upon thousands upon tens of thousands upon hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of dollars in government Medicare and Medicaid money. And funny, I don't see him sit. I haven't seen him singing Decamp Town Races and shuffling along with shackles around his ankles or a bayonet at his back. I'm particularly fond of the plumbing analogy. Basically, once you imply a belief in a right to someone's services, do you have a right to plumbing? Do you have a right to water? Do you have a right to food? Well, you're basically saying you believe in slavery. Yep, there we are. All us folks out here enslaved to life. I mean, I know an easy way for Rand Paul to get away from all this risk of slavery. It's called suicide. And he wouldn't have to worry about that food and light and water and heat and shelter, all that Maslowian the hierarchy of needs stuff. If he'd just go ahead and shuffle off this mortal coil and end his misery and ours as well. But he won't, because he's a gutless libertarian coward whose only mantra in life is get for me. Money. I love money. But that right to plumbing, it's not so much a right to plumbing, it's a requirement of plumbing. Most societies that consider themselves enlightened try to avoid having their citizens poop in the street. And the ones who do poop in the street, we generally take them off to have a conversation with a physician of competent board certification. A right to plumbing? No, but it is a public necessity that we have it so that you don't wind up with things like cholera. So that you don't wind up having to put bayonets in doctors' backs to march along, we're going to go treat the cholera outbreak. A right to plumbing? No, but it is a mandate. We have a requirement of plumbing. Try to build a house with no plumbing. See how far you get. Because we have these things called codes, but I'm sure in Rand Paul libertarian ophthalmologist world, building codes are communism too. You have a right to beat down my door with the police, escort me away, and force me to take care of you? For money? Lots and lots of money? Oh, perish the thought. These people make me sick. I mean, really. Bear in mind, this past November, the present sitting pope declared that health care is an inalienable right of man. Again, from the Credit Where Credit Is Due department, he said, justice in health care should be a priority of governments and international institutions. Of course, I guess the Pope's pronouncements probably matter less to an aqua Buddhist than they do even to me. But still, recognizing that, because, no, we did, last night was prayer meeting. I'm not going to use that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go there. Now, this is the same Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, who has, and you know, no kidding, pissed and moaned about not getting enough money from the government. It was this same Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, who said he doesn't want to cut Medicare payments to doctors like himself because, and this is the quote, physicians should be allowed to make a comfortable living. I'm comfortably well off. I'm socially secure. I'm rich. 50%, back before he got elected to the Senate and whatnot, 50% of Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist patients, are on Medicare. Which is, you know, socialized medicine. It's just socialized medicine for a fairly narrowly defined group of American citizens. Physicians should be allowed to make a comfortable living, especially if they're libertarian ophthalmologists who are taking a big pee-pee in the street all over their libertarian ophthalmological values in order to cash the government checks. So they're hypocrites. So what else is new? Now, on the other hand, you have the thoughts of a considered, intelligent, compassionate, humane, decent human being. All of the above being things that Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, is not. Are not. Whichever. You have Bernie Sanders. Andy just wrote in from California. He said, this is the antithesis of Senator Rand Paul's comment. Remember, according to Senator Paul, don't get sick, and if you do, die quickly. Republican mantra. Slavery. How's this moron even get there? Mr. Paul is a twisted, warped individual. We don't deserve our for-profit healthcare system. No country does. It's a national disgrace, as you have alluded to on many occasions. Thanks, Andy. Senator Bernie Sanders wrote an article. It was, of course, published not in the New York Times, not in the Philadelphia Inquirer, not in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, not in the Burlington Battle Cry of Freedom and Daily Moral Volcano, not in the Chicago Tribune, not in the L.A. Times, not nowhere on this here continent. No, Senator Bernie Sanders' comments were published in The Guardian of the U.K., He notes, the United States is the only major nation in the industrialized world that does not guarantee health care as a right to its people. Meanwhile, we spend about twice as much per capita on health care, and in a wide number of instances, our outcomes are not as good as others that spend far less. It is time that we bring about a fundamental transformation of the American healthcare system. It is time for us to end private for-profit participation in delivering basic coverage. It is time for the United States to provide a Medicare for All single-payer healthcare coverage program. Hallelujah. Amen. Under our dysfunctional system, writes Senator Sanders, 45,000 Americans die every year because they delay seeking care they cannot afford. That's what it means when we say that 45,000 people a year die because they don't have health insurance. They don't die of some incurable disease. They die because they don't go to the doctor because they can't afford to go to the doctor, and then they die. 45,000 of them. Odds are, if you are within the reach of my voice in the United States, you know someone in that circumstance, and somebody is going to go to somebody else's funeral on account of the repig-licking obsession with unholy profit. Senator Sanders didn't say any of that. That's all me. This is Senator Sanders again. We spent 17.6% of our gross domestic product on health care in 2009, which is projected to go up to 20% by 2020. Yet we still rank 26th. USA, 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 we're 26th, we're 26th, we're 26th. Right? Oh, by the way, we're 31st on infant mortality. USA, USA, we're 31, we're 31. And I'm proud to be an American. Senator Sanders says we must demand a better model of health coverage that emphasizes preventive and primary care for every single person without regard to their ability to pay. It is certainly a step forward that the new health reform law is projected to cover 32 million additional Americans out of the more than 50 million uninsured today. Even after that, though, roughly 23 million will still be without insurance in 2019, while health care costs will continue to skyrocket because they are based and derived from the essential motivating reality of corporate America, which is to make a profit off everything. Even grim death, misery, illness, disease, agony. There is nothing that the anarcho-predatory capitalist system of the United States of this here America will not attempt to profitize. Because profit is everything. Everything. That's not just some throwaway phrase. Take a moment. Look around you. See if you can lay your eye, set your eye upon anything in your immediate world that at some point in time has not been profitized by some aspect of the American consumer culture. You can't, can you? I didn't think so. I can't either. But the sickest part of that analysis is when you realize that even if you look at your own flesh, it has been profitized, amortized, commercialized. You know, we used to joke about, and some people still do, you know, I think politicians ought to wear them kind of jumpsuits like them NASCAR drivers wear, got patches and advertisements all over. And that's true. But the fact of the matter is, we, not on little jumpsuits, but we should have tattooed all over our flesh the trademarks and logos of all the various entities in this country who exist solely to commercialize our very lives, to capitalize our lives. You know, capital punishment used to mean that your life was taken away from you. Execution, you know. But we live in the 21st century in the United States of America, where now capital punishment is simply the standard of life for every being that is alive now or will come to life in this nation any time in the near future or the distant, as far as I can see. Capital punishment is what happens to you when you emerge from the womb and various and sundry anarcho-predatory corporations begin the process of capitalizing every blessed thing about your existence. We talk about things like free will, and all the libertarians are big on some free will. I may have to fire up some Rush here in a minute. Libertarians love them some free will. But the fact of the matter is, there's no such thing anymore. You, in the United States of America, have no choice. You have no free will. You will be subjected to the profit motive and the capitalization of the very blood that runs through your veins and the air that goes into your lungs and the food that goes through your mouth. You are a vehicle of profit. And as such, it is your punishment, your burden in this world to bear the relentless, merciless drive for the capitalization even unto your soul. You know, Joe Bagent wrote a lot about this. He wrote an essay based upon an address that he gave to some psych students at a university in Chicago. Maybe it was the University of Chicago. And he talked about the illusion that we maintain for ourselves that, you know, we're different. No, you're not. The amount of food produced for actual personal consumption by the few people within this audience who do try to do so is so small as to be statistically insignificant. If you do produce your own food, odds are you bought it. You bought the seed stock for it or the plant for it from some profit-driven company. I've got an article here, and it is an article that fits very nicely in this whole discussion. And there's it comes from a website called organicconsumers.org. It's the Organic Consumers Association. Bruce Robinson wrote it for Common Dreams on May the 8th of this year. And he asks in the second paragraph of his essay, "Does it bother you that we consumers are largely unaware that 70 to 80% of the processed foods we buy contain genetically modified ingredients? We are largely unaware because these foods are not labeled, even though 90% of Americans want them labeled and think that we have the right to know what's in our food. The biotech industry fights labeling viciously because they know that if GM foods were labeled, many would refuse to buy them, as is the case in Europe. It's not financial considerations that leave us with no choice. It's our lack of awareness that allows them to take advantage of us. How many realize that Kraft mac and cheese is non-genetically modified in Europe, but does contain genetically modified ingredients in the United States? And he points out how it gets to be this way. Our regulatory bodies and government are staffed with pro-GM people, a veritable revolving door. Michael Taylor, a Monsanto lawyer, moved from Monsanto to the Food and Drug Administration, where he wrote the rules that were used to justify the release of Monsanto's bovine growth hormone, RBGH. Then he went back to Monsanto as a vice president. Right now, he's the FDA deputy commissioner for foods. Really? Foods, deputy commissioner, FDA. And it's not like these are isolated instances. No, not at all. Today, it was announced that Federal Communications Commissioner Meredith Atwell Baker is jumping ship from the FCC. She's leaving June the 3rd. Well, at least she turned in a two-week notice. Where is she going? She is going immediately to Comcast NBC Universal. What's she going to be there? She's going to be the Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs. What's that mean? That means that the commercialization, the capitalization, the profitization of the airwaves that the public owns will be more relentlessly and mercilessly pursued. Vice President of Governmental Affairs, that's fancy corporate speak for head lobbyist. Yeah, she's going to leave her job in the government and turn around and lobby the government to do the bidding of Comcast NBC Universal, whose goal, of course, is to monetize, capitalize, commercialize, profitize the Internet. And that will be an Internet that has no room for me, no room for a horn, no room for small Internet-based broadcasters, no room for Rick Smith, no room for Mike Malloy, no room for Tom Hartman, no room for Stephanie Miller, no room for Hal Sparks, no room for Sam Cedar. Because everyone I've just mentioned is, if not openly hostile, then at least not sufficiently servile to the profitization, commercialization, capitalization, and monetization of every blessed thing on the planet. Whew. Hard to stomach, I know. Gosh, Meredith Atwell Baker. Goodbye. Goodbye. Have a nice time screwing us. Goodbye. Yeah, Meredith Atwell Baker was one of the two Republican commissioners at the FCC, you see. And in addition, well, you want to know why she's going to go be Senior Vice President for Governmental Affairs for Comcast NBC Universal? You want to know why? Because she voted in favor of the Comcast buyout of NBC. Free press. a wonderful organization, Free Press's Craig Aaron, noted, "No wonder the public is so nauseated by business as usual in Washington, where the complete capture of government by industry barely raises any eyebrows. The continuously revolving door at the FCC continues to erode any prospects for good public policy. We hope, but won't hold our breath, that her replacement will be someone who is not just greasing the way for their next industry job." Well, Craig, buddy, I think we're probably on the same side in this argument. But let me encourage you to hope in one hand and in the other one and see which one fills up first, buddy. But you see, when corporations privatize, monetize, capitalize, commercialize, and profitize the commons, that's not slavery. That's not theft. That's not improper conversion. That's just business. And when we talk about business, we run up the flag and put our hands on our hearts and take our John Deere ball caps off and sing, "God bless American business and Jesus." To see, if it's ours, they can steal it from us, but they're not thieves. But if we, on the other hand, ask, please, more please, if we ask for some modest crumb of the commons to be left the hell alone, by God, we're moochers. And we're enslaving poor Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, and marching him at bayonet point out at 3 o'clock in the morning to work on Granny's bifocals. Clayton writing, Rand Paul still in Kentucky? Better rethink that one about the housing code. Last time I took my daughter to Livingston, Kentucky, we visited the Bingham Cafe. We were given orange water. No, he doesn't mean orange pop. The water was orange. My daughter never saw such a thing. I took her out back to see the outhouse next to the well behind the cafe. Oh, the outhouse was a two-holer. Damn, they still don't have a housing code in Kentucky. Peace, Clayton. And that's the way God wants it, and that's why Jesus put it in the Declaration of Independence. You want to scream? Does this bring you up just something a little short of crazy? Because it's not. And by the way, lest you attempt to delude yourself into thinking that this is something that is a Repiglican problem, let me promptly disabuse you of that. There was an article over at Salon a couple of days ago, and I read it with some interest, realizing that, you know what? This might be handy. It was called. I'm trying to come. What was the actual title? Barack Obama's stealth campaign to there it is. Obama's quiet strike against the socialist label. You're just gonna plumb love this. Jonathan Easley is the author. It's from Sunday. In the past 2 weeks, President Obama dramatically freed himself from his enemy's suggestion that he is too foreign with the release of his long-form birth certificate and too weak with the killing of Osama bin Laden. But you might have missed a subtler move by the president that could further erode his opponent's push to brand him a socialist. Now, there's only one problem with that hypothesis, and that is that facts don't matter a tinker's damn when it comes to teabaggers and birthers and deathers and tenthers and fourteenthers and corpsers and booger eaters and house helmet wearers when they decide to say scurrilous things about the president, because it all has nothing to do with actual politics. It has everything to do with the fact that he's, you know, darker than a grocery bag. But anyway, Jonathan Easley continues, "This past week, the administration asked Congress to form a commission to fast-track the sale of excess federal property in an attempt to wipe some zeros from the tail end of the deficit figure." I'm reading along. Oh, excess federal property. That means they want to cut out a couple of bureaucratic hoop-jumping exercises so that they can sell those old Dell computers from 10 years ago. They can sell them at auction and, you know, maybe for 10, 15 bucks a piece. No. "The sale of public real estate to private interests has real estate? Oh, we're talking about real property. Realty. The sale of public real estate to private interests has bipartisan support." Oh, I'll bet it does. But it's more significant than that. It's an indication that under Democratic leadership, the U.S. government is beginning to behave as an entity that is concerned with such fiscal trivialities as ledgers and balance sheets. It's the opposite of state socialism and nationalization, the goals that Obama's critics on the right have relentlessly claimed that he's pursuing, and which, incidentally, they will continue to claim he is pursuing, even if he gets up and starts, selling individual bricks in the Washington Monument. The administration has identified a massive asset class worth unloading. The federal government is the largest owner of real estate in the nation, sitting on hundreds of millions of useless acres of land, now I added the useless part, that takes up about 30% of the country's surface. The value of Uncle Sam's non-defense real estate portfolio is estimated at $230 billion, and it carries a maintenance cost of around $20 billion a year. 60% of sale proceeds, if the Congress approves the plan, from properties the White House has deemed excess. Excess property. I love the concept. It's so Orwellian as to be giggle-inducing. Excess property. Because, you know, they're making new land every day. The only problem is you have to go down into one of the really, really deep, deep trenches in the ocean to see where it's being made. We have a listener who actually does that kind of work. And he sent me one time a picture from the seafloor of a little baby volcano being born. And I just went, wow. Yeah, that's where we're building new land. Unfortunately, it's not happening in the United States, so the concept that we've got excess federal property just beats me to pieces. Properties the White House has deemed excess will go to paying down the deficit, with 40% to cover costs on other government-run facilities. In addition to the one-time cash from the sale, the government can begin generating tax revenues on land that was previously just an expense. Just don't get too excited about landing a piece of the Grand Canyon. The administration describes its first round of sales as sheds, underutilized office buildings, and empty warehouses. They've even got an interactive map. Wonder who's going to buy all that. I could use a shed. Hell, if it's got a viable roof, I might live in it. As long as it's got plumbing. Well, then again, Rand Paul says it doesn't need to have plumbing. Because insisting it has plumbing will be the same as putting a bayonet at his back and marching him off to fix Granny's glasses. F him. Oh, God. That's where we are, isn't it? It most assuredly is. That's where we find ourselves. You know, for something to be a part of the public commons, it does not have to be pretty and green with sheep on it. It doesn't have to be the Grand Canyon. It really can be an office building or a warehouse. And I love the way that the Salon article talks about this being property owned by the government. Because little linguistic moments like that are signposts to where we are in relation to the origins of this country. More on that later. When you describe property owned by as being owned by the government, then you de facto create a sort of psychic space between government and governed. Now, that's no big deal if your country is run by a human being who thinks that God gave the imprimatur of rule to them by some, the hereditary right of kings and queens and princes and vicomtes and comtes and viziers and rajas and all that royalist horse shit. But in a state whose very political existence is predicated upon the government being comprised of we, the people of the United States, then that psychic space between government and governed is not a healthy thing. And it also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The wider that gulf becomes, the more servile and acquiescent some members of society themselves become in turn. And other segments of society, earthers, baggers, deathers, tenthers, fourteenthers, corpsers, booger eaters, house helmet wearers, oatmeal dribblers, the more they become convinced that the government is an enemy. And the combination of those two groups creates a sort of critical mass for just how far the idea of self-government can fall until it is eventually done away with entirely. And the selling off of the commons, even if it be nothing more than a warehouse with a single toilet, is actually a little bitty signpost on the road to the end of the experiment that we know as America. It's a hell of a start for tonight, wouldn't you say? It's about 3 minutes before the hour. Your phone calls when we come back, you know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email, if you wish to do that instead of calling in, 304-6, no, that's the phone number, isn't it, Bob? No, Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. Emphasis on that listener-supported part. We are looking for 29 people, just 29 people, sending $10 apiece tonight to try to help us draw even with where we need to be in the month of March. 29 people. You know, when you compare that with the fundraising drives of other organizations out there on the web, we've got to raise $30,000 between now and midnight. It's pretty humble, isn't it? $290. Less than 5 cents an hour per program. 29 people, $10. Or one person at $290. I don't care. Because it all does the same thing and makes this programming available for anyone who wants to hear it, regardless of ability to pay. It is a lovely resistance to and rejection of the notion that you and I are mere sheep led to the profitable slaughter. Let the entire world try to monetize and capitalize and corporatize, profitize you. I won't do it. And we, all of us at the Horn, won't do it. We ask for no more than it takes to keep all of this thing running on a shoestring. Not to make a profit. Not to turn you into some further manifestation of the sickness of greed that infests this nation. $290. 29 people. $10 apiece. And many thanks to those of you who have already contributed so that I'm not sitting here talking about 60 people at $10 apiece. So we'll be back right here on the Horn. Green News Report is next. Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen on the way with their usual excellent roundup of environmental news.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, May 12, 2011.
If your company didn't need incentives to drill for oil at $55 a barrel, how in the world can you possibly need incentives when oil is at $100 a barrel?
Oil industry on the hot seat again, fighting to hold on to their billion-dollar taxpayer subsidies. Renewable energy can replace fossil fuels by 2050. Plus, satirists attack. Fossil fuel industry cries foul.
Poor fossil fuel industry. All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
If you pay taxes in this country, in America, then you as an individual human American taxpayer, you pay more in taxes than ExxonMobil.
Well, that sounds totally fair.
In 2009, Exxon reported $19 billion in profit. What did they pay in terms of tax on that? They got an IRS rebate of $156 million. Sweet deal.
Sweet deal indeed. I gotta get me an oil company. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, the head of the oil companies were on Capitol Hill today answering questions on the hot seat, explaining why it is they make billions and billions in profits and they still get welfare from the government.
Yeah, it was fascinating kabuki theater masquerading as a Senate hearing on taxpayer incentives for the oil industry. But we'll get to that in a moment. First, get your free asthma inhaler from the coal industry.
Free asthma inhaler from the coal company? That's perfect. It's as if coal companies care.
Oh, you'd think, but not really. Peabody Energy, a coal company, got quite a PR headache this week when they were spoofed by the corporate pranksters, the Yes Men. The Yes Men set up a fake website called coalcares.org, purportedly sponsored by Peabody Energy, giving away free asthma inhalers to kids made sick by air pollution from coal, which is a primary cause of asthma.
And they made asthma seem cool. They have Justin Bieber inhalers. It was a really funny website, and they sent out a press release with it, and a lot of people bought it, thought it was real.
Yeah, but Peabody was not amused. No word yet on whether they will try to sue, like the billionaire Koch brothers, the conservative oil billionaires who bankrolled the climate change denial industry, who got quite the smackdown this week when a federal judge dismissed their lawsuit against another group for also setting up a parody website that claimed Koch industry had recognized its error and would support climate change legislation.
What's hysterical is these companies, Peabody, Coke Industries, they all get really, really ticked off when these people go out and say they're doing really nice things. Oh, the irony.
Renewables can make up to 80% of the energy supply for the entire planet by 2050. That, according to a new analysis by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. To get to 80% of renewable fuels over the next 40 years is doable with intense development and deployment of renewable energy and a heavy focus on energy efficiency, the study says. The only thing standing in the way is the lack of political will. And that lack of political will was obvious in a U.S. Senate committee hearing on Thursday when Big Oil was called on the carpet. The CEOs of the world's five largest oil companies testified at a Senate Finance Committee hearing to justify why the oil industry, in the midst of record profits from near-record gas prices, should continue to receive $4 billion every year in taxpayer incentives and tax breaks.
It will make it more difficult for us to do business, raise the cost of doing business, ultimately produce less in revenue for the U.S. government, fewer jobs, and move against the president's agenda of reducing imported oil.
That was Dr. John Watson, CEO of Chevron.
So he's holding the country hostage. He's saying, if you stop giving us our free money, our free corporate welfare, we will raise the gas prices on you. There's nothing you can do about it. Keep giving us our free money, despite the fact that Chevron, they made $10 billion for profits in 2009, yet they still need their free money, and they're willing to take down the U.S. economy if we stop giving it to them.
Some important things to note, it's a fact that removing these taxpayer incentives will have no effect whatsoever on gas prices, as confirmed yet again this week by the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service. It's a fact that increasing domestic drilling will have no impact on gasoline prices. It's a fact that Republicans on the Senate Finance Committee received four times the campaign cash from the oil industry as Democrats. Good government group Public Citizen responded to the oil industry claims, saying they spend far more of their profits on stock buybacks than they spend on production.
It's also a fact that you can get more on all of this at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. It's also a fact that bradblog.com gets no
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap, there's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Little genius, we got your soap right here.
And got your bath body stuff.
www.littlegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Yes, indeed. 12 minutes past the hour. And I'd say it's about time to go back to, or go to the phones. I apparently inadvertently set the Wayback Machine for a couple of months back. Somewhere along in what I was saying before the hour rounded out, I referred to this being March. Obviously, this is not a rerun, and I don't want to confuse anybody. This is May, and this show is live. Thanks for noticing, Randall. Corey writing in about the hearing where Rand Paul declared that he was being forced at bayonet point out at 3 o'clock in the morning to fix Granny's glasses because he's done been conscripted. Conscriptulated, I think, is what the proper usage of the term is. Done been conscriptulated. Corey said, my senator spoke during that hearing. Unfortunately, says Corey, I don't live in Vermont, so I can't vote for him directly. It is sad that my senator, the one who speaks for me, lives in a state nearly 1,000 miles away, and the ones who allegedly represent my state have zero interest in the welfare of my state. And that's a similar sensation for a lot of us here behind the cornbread curtain. And no one of like mind with me, we don't have any political representation whatsoever. We've got a Mountain Party candidate we can vote for in the upcoming the gubernatorial election that opposes mountaintop removal. But people who are registered Democrats, no, hell no. They don't have any representation. There is not a single Democrat running for governor in this state who is willing to say that people living in this state deserve not to be poisoned to death, which is what is happening. So I sympathize with Corey. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey,
Susan.
About Rand Paul.
Libertarian ophthalmologist, yes.
Yeah, you need to spit over the board one more time. I can just see your face as you're doing that. I thought he, when he became a doctor, he,
Are you going to haul out that tired out, tired old worn out Hippocratic Oath or something? You're not going to do that, are you, Susan?
A bayonet. It's called a Hippocratic Oath.
Well, I'm sure that Rand would explain to you that that was written at a time when people hadn't come to their good senses and realized that the true state of humankind is libertarianism, in which one dies and dies quickly if one cannot afford health care.
Tell that to Dr. Mudd. However, if you care to take Dr. Paul's... God, that just cracks me up.
I often think about Dr. Paul, and then I think about his mother, Mrs. Paul.
Yeah.
All those fish sticks, all those years.
If you take this man's example to its logical insanity, that means if I was a health care provider, and at one time I was, this man's wife and or children could come to me for help. They could be dying. And because I disagreed with their daddy's politics, I could say,
go die.
Die.
Yep.
I really don't want to...
Beautiful thing, libertarianism, isn't it?
Yes. They don't bother to take it to its complete insanity. They just take it as far as they want it to go.
But it fills me with dread and revulsion. And it fills me with despair when I realize that when he says crap like that, that there is, 20-30% of America that goes, that's right. That's right. If I ain't rich enough to see the doctor, I deserve to die because that means Jesus don't love me.
Yeah, well, those are the 20-30% of the countries that I've already written off.
Well, you can write them off till the cows come home. But the fact of the matter is, 20-30% of anything is enough to ruin the other 70%. You know, one bad apple, all of that business, that's one bad apple out of a barrel of 200. It will ruin the other 199. That's way more than enough to ruin this entire nation.
But what I'm trying to say is, we can overcome that 20-30% if we act intelligently.
Well, I think we're capable of that.
What we have to do is act intelligently. Which means don't get into fights over piddly little things, which, let's face it, liberals and Democrats are notorious for. They snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory with great regularity by getting into wars over the stupidest things. We need to keep our eyes on what matters.
The prize, as it were?
Yeah, and which means keeping that 20-30% in line and doing what they're told. They're fine as long as they're told what to do, when to do it, and sit down and shut up.
As the corrections professional would say, they need structure.
Yeah, exactly. They need structure and the quote from the movie, right now we have a problem communicating.
Yeah, so, Cool Hand Luke. What we have here is failure to communicate.
Failure to communicate. Now, I'm not to the point where I'm going to go as far as that movie went, but we need to put them in a position where they are incapable of causing any more problems. And that means render them politically useless.
But how are you going to do that when they comprise entire states? Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, Georgia, Louisiana, Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina, Arkansas, Oklahoma.
I know
Arizona, Nevada, Utah, Idaho. That's a pretty big swath of Jesus land there, Susan.
Yeah, I wouldn't count on a lot of those states, especially Texas. Have you looked at the demographics lately?
Oh, Texas is going to be going through some changes.
Yeah, the entire Southwest is. Why do you think the Republicans are so frantic to pass papers, please, laws there? They're freaking out down there because they know they are about to get rendered irrelevant.
But then again, I wouldn't be so quick on that, Susan, because look at the population demographics of the state of Mississippi. Now, consider who runs Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
It is the political leadership of the state of Mississippi is certainly not indicative of what its real population demographics are.
I realize that.
And, you know, it's heartbreaking. I don't know if you saw this story. Did you see what Haley Baba did?
Yeah.
Was that just gut-gagging sickening?
I have to.
All along the Mississippi River banks of the state of Mississippi.
People are drowning.
People are drowning. The hellacious flooding, you know, 100-year flooding.
Yeah, and they're losing everything they've got, and basically, you know, Barber's telling them, go piss up the rope.
I love this excerpt. As the water rose, Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour moved furniture out of his lake house outside of Vicksburg on family land that was inundated during the 1927 flood. A week ago, he urged residents to flee low-lying areas, saying that the state wouldn't assist the evacuations and that people should help one another secure their property and get out.
Yeah.
You're on your own, Bubba.
Yeah. Mississippi has not, you know, this also ties in with Rand Paul and his comments about, you know, the free market and the, you know, that bit with the lunch counters. Because Mississippi is something of a special case, because I can still remember, tell me, and I know you remember this too, do you really think the free market had anything to do with any comfort to the families of those three kids that ended up in that earthen dam down in Mississippi?
Of course not.
Of course not. And it's still pretty much the same way. There has been very little change in Mississippi.
Right. And even after the demographics in Texas changed dramatically, how much will be different there? That's my point.
Well, what I'm saying is the demographics are changing, but I don't think the demographics are changing that much in Mississippi. I really don't.
Well, it is not and never has been a majority white state.
No. But where in the Southwest you had Hispanics flooding in, Mississippi, no, you didn't really have, as far as I know, maybe I'm wrong, you didn't really have that many, that big a Hispanic population to offset it. And that's what's provided the tipping point in all of these Southwestern states, is the Hispanic voter blocks are moving in, and they are voting Democratic. And you combine them with the black voter blocks and the liberal white voter block, and all of a sudden you've got a bunch of very, very scared white Republicans. I don't think you have that in Mississippi. I could very well be wrong, but I don't think you do.
Well, you do with the influx, because Mississippi is a right-to-work state. There is a significant influx of Latino workers, and yeah, that's it. But again, you know, because of the bigotry and the hatred and the immigration status of a lot of them, it's going to be hard for that to shift any of the political landscape either.
Yeah, and you know, I do know that it's changing even in Idaho because they're having a lot of legal Hispanics. I'm not talking about illegals. I'm talking about legals moving into Idaho. I'm hearing this from people who are living in Idaho, and it's freaking the Republican majority out because they're voting straight Democratic tickets.
And the Republicans, they do that because the Republicans give them nothing to vote for.
Yeah.
Because they are steeped in their hate.
Yeah, exactly. But you've got all these Hispanics moving into these, what you would think are red states. And it's shifting. This country can't live without its immigrants. People who say, shut off all the immigration, they're crazy. Without immigration, this country stagnates. It dies.
And it's run on the sweat and blood of immigrants, well, from the moment we started stealing the land from the people who already lived here.
Not just the sweat and blood, but also the imagination and ideas of the people who come to this country. Without their input, without their new blood, this country goes down the tubes.
And you can see that in the baggers and deathers and birthers and booger eaters. And, right, sure.
Yeah. They are the people who have turned their back on the future and are saying, I want to go back to the 1950s. Well, sorry, fellas, don't work that way. You go forward, or you get run over. That's your choice.
Seems rather obvious.
Adapt or die, ancient. It's simple as that. An amoeba understands that on a basic level. Adapt or die. The 20 or 30% are the people who are refusing to adapt.
It's a compelling argument.
Simple as that. Anyway, give my love to Agnes and the kids.
Oh, I certainly will. And you have a good evening, Susan.
Do something for me, will you, please?
I will try.
Say it again. I love to hear it.
What? Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist?
It cracks me up.
I'm socially secure.
I was a cartoon kid. And you and Daffy Duck, you know.
Well, see, Daffy Duck is just such an everyman. You have to love him.
Well, him and Marvin the Martian. That's one of the reasons why I buy Stephanie Miller's podcast, is because every now and then, Jim will toss in a little bit of Marvin the Martian.
No,
and I just go, oh, cool.
You humans make me very angry.
Oh, you can do him, too.
Absolutely.
Delays, delays. The Elodian Q-32 exploding space modulator has been stolen.
I adore Marvin.
My view of Venus is obstructed by that pesky Earth.
Yeah. Big fan of Marvin. And the Tasmanian Devil as well.
And rabbits.
Oh, yeah. Yes. The Tasmanian Devil was...
They're embedded in my brain. I can't remember the quadratic equation, but I can remember lines from Warner Brothers cartoons. Susan, have a wonderful night.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Susan. Let's see. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Yes.
Andy.
Hey, Andy. What's up?
Not much. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you.
That's good. I was just in a cafe trying to get outside, so you might hear some car traffic, but You know, I was listening to one of your old shows, and you made a comment about the Yankees running at Manassas.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Ah. I wonder if
they were put. They were put into full route, full flight twice at first and second bull run.
I wonder if at Cemetery Ridge, the first Minnesotans had ran. Maybe we wouldn't. Maybe Jefferson Davis in the South, Richmond, to be running the United States, huh?
Well, I don't know. Everybody loves to speculate on the one that everybody loves is Devil's Den, and what happens if Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain doesn't execute that obscure gate hinge movement. And
15th Alabama, Bob.
Yeah.
It was the 15th Alabama. They ran, Bob.
Yep.
My great-great-grandfather was there. I was kind of taken a little offense by your comment. I don't know if he was at Manassas, but I know he was at Gettysburg. But anyway, yeah, the 15th Alabama just kind of was shocked when old Joshua and the boys took out the steel.
Yeah. And butchered them wholesale.
I don't know if he did that, but...
Well, no, they did. I mean, they were there, and they were off in the woods, and he executed that gate hinge movement and basically caught him in a pincer and just slaughtered the hell out of him.
Yeah, I know. I knew they were completely caught by surprise, and they...
Well, nobody, you know, even the generals, even the Union generals, what the hell's he doing?
Yeah.
But he was an academic. He was an
academic.
He was an academic. And
ammunition.
Yeah. And so they fixed bayonets and did that sort of that movement and changed the tide of the war.
Yeah.
Theoretically, at least.
No, I think it was a big turning point of the war for them to stop them at Gettysburg, stop the South.
Well, yeah, because the whole goal, you know, the goal was to force a negotiated peace. And if they couldn't win Gettysburg, they couldn't win. But, you know, Southern people are crazy and by crazy I don't mean insane. I mean, they love to debate the what-ifs of things like the second day of Gettysburg, or what happens if I can't remember his name now, the general at Shiloh, if he doesn't bleed to death in his boot, because he was the leading light of the entire American military. Albert Sidney Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
The Southerners love to debate that stuff.
Right. Well, anyway, you know, another topic. I sent you an email, a couple shows ago, I guess, concerning, I heard nobody talk about this plebiscite that took place in Great Britain for, they call it the alternative vote, which would give them rank voting.
Right.
Some other European countries.
Yeah, what's referred to in some places as instant runoff voting?
Well, IRV, instant runoff voting, is another implement, which I think is close to what they wanted to do. You're probably correct, which they do have in some places, in San Francisco and in Oakland, which I just want people to know, if you want to change our political system, having that kind of voting process, methodology, is a great way to go to get progressive candidates elected.
Absolutely.
And the Liberal Party, who's the co-governing party with the Tories, they believe if they had ranked voting in the last election, they would have 130 seats instead of the 57 that they have now. So it could triple the amount of seats that the Liberal Party could have. This is just in England.
Well, you know, I had a conversation with John Fox once upon a time, Andy, and I guess there's some variation of that in Australia as well.
Yeah.
And it works. It certainly didn't stop the so-called liberals who were actually conservatives, you know, who were the Bush bootlickers during the Bush administration, didn't stop them from getting into power. But it certainly does it gives
smaller parties a chance.
Right.
It's what it gives, because you can then you don't have to worry about throwing your vote away, because your vote can still go to somebody else, especially if you have like a real right wing candidate that you know has a good chance of winning that election, and if you throw your vote away for the third party candidate, which you think might not have a chance, but now you can throw your weight with the second.
Yeah, because you rank your choices.
Right. And this is something that we should be doing here in the United States. You know, our voting system, the whole electoral process is bad enough because, you know, the whole Senate is just a joke because of the underrepresentation. Like states like Wyoming, who have, what, 500,000 people, and then you have states like California with almost 40 million having two senators. Makes absolutely no sense. It's just a joke. Anyway. We need something to even the odds and that kind of alternative. I'm just amazed. You didn't hear anything about it here in the United States that vote even took place in England. You know, hardly any.
Well, until I saw your email, I wasn't aware of it either.
Yeah, and the New York Times did a small piece on it, but it was in, you know, like page 20 or something like that. The Financial Times covered it, but that was all I ever saw. And the BBC gave it a few lines. But it's a shame. I mean, it's something.
Well, doesn't that tell you what the for-profit media thinks of the idea or think of the idea?
Yeah, you got that right.
I mean, isn't that another one of those Emma Goldman moments? If voting worked, it would be illegal.
Yeah. Exactly. Another thing I want to talk about too is speculation. You know, with our oil price, I've heard some people saying that, you know, speculation doesn't play a role in this. And this is so insane. There was an article the other day on the front page of the Times about one of the hedge funds in England. I think it's called Clive Capital. In 1 week, they lost $400 million speculating on oil. Give me a break. And there are there are 8,000 hedge funds. If there were only 10% of them speculating on oil, that'd be 800 of them. I mean, the speculation in oil, I think, is rampant, and the hedge funds doing it has got to be rampant. I mean, there was one of the most profitable divisions of Citigroup, I think it was called Philbro, which is now a private hedge fund run by one of the richest men in the world. I forget the guy's name, but that's all they do is commodities, and mainly oil and gas futures and speculation and derivatives products. I mean, for people not to think that speculation, it's not the total price, but it is definitely a large share of the increase in prices.
Well, how can it not be when, you know, when there's a futures market for it?
Right. Absolutely.
I mean, to argue that speculation isn't part of it is to argue that that nobody's buying futures in crude.
Right.
And we know that not to be true.
Right. I think a government report has taken 30 to 40% of the price run-ups are due to speculation. But this could definitely be turned around because this wasn't possible before the Commodities and Futures Exchange Act of 2000. That really opened things up.
Well, is that what people refer to as the Enron? Yeah, the Enron loophole.
Exactly. Exactly. A lot of this stuff couldn't be done before then. It wasn't nearly as volatile. Prices didn't change nearly as much in the frequency of time that it does before that. I mean, you'd think they could just roll that back, but they won't do it. Now they just can't get
the... Well, I mean, this is the same crowd in the House of Representatives that just doesn't quite have it in them to say that the oil companies don't deserve corporate welfare.
Yeah, that's $4 billion in corporate subsidies. What a joke. The most, you know, as people say, Mike Malloy and others have said, you know, this is the most profit-driven industry on the face of the earth ever in the history of our planet, and here they're getting tax subsidies. This is incredible. I think in the first quarter they made like $35 billion, five companies made $35 billion in one quarter in profits. They're getting a subsidy. Oh, my Lord.
And, you know, when you've got profits like that, and this is far more your bailiwick than mine, Andy, what does that mean on a per-share breakdown, you know, in terms of declaring a dividend? I mean, how many shares do you have to own in order for those kind of profits to generate some real folding, walking around money?
And those profits, I believe, are after dividends.
Oh, those Jesus.
They're already netted out.
Wow.
They're already taken.
Holy cow.
They're probably giving, you know, they're giving huge dividends, you know, what, maybe 6-7% or something like that of the value of the stock in dividends, maybe. I don't know what it is on oil companies, but there's no doubt that they do give dividends. Yeah, I believe that's netted out of there.
Jesus.
That you're seeing the after dividend figure with the profits.
That's astonishing.
But yeah, they're making some real money. Real money.
But the thing, and this is, you know, I get lost in the weeds on a lot of this stuff, Andy. But that real money's coming from somewhere. That money.
Pockets.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's a siphon that runs from working people's wallets to the lobster for lunch crowds, Maseratis.
Right.
I mean, is that fair? Is that reasonably accurate?
Well, CEO salaries are up, I've heard, 24% and something like 27%, two different figures of the last year. So there's no doubt corporate America is doing wonderfully well. They're sitting on a wad of cash. I've heard like $3 to $4 trillion in cash still. I mean, we've been talking about this. CEO salaries are way up. It's the best of times if you're positioned correctly.
Oh, yeah, it's one of those Mel Brooks good-to-be-the-king kind of moments, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here, I went to a job fair like 2 weeks ago. Gosh, there were hundreds of people there with unbelievable backgrounds. It's just incredible. Looking for
scientists,
work.
Scientists, geniuses.
So many people looking for work. It's astounding to see how many good people are out of work. People with great educational backgrounds. You know, top schools, lots of experience on the street. It is mind-boggling. It truly is. Anyway, too, I can't get over Obama also with this justice thing, that justice was done. He still keeps saying that.
Oh, that they're messaging hard on that, Andy.
Yeah, they are. Another thing, that immigration speech he gave, I like that too. He's saying how, we got to let the best and the brightest in this country, you know, given the pitch for the H-1Bs. We still got to let the best in the world, because they create jobs. Gee, haven't we been doing this, Bob? Haven't we been letting the best and the brightest in? Where are the jobs? I don't get it. We've been doing that. That has been our policy.
Well, and there's another little...
jobs. Is something supposed to change?
There's another little problem too, Andy, and that is at the same time that he was saying we got to do this, yada yada yada, his immigration the ICE agency is actually actively prosecuting deportation proceedings against one of the brilliant, high-profile people pushing for the DREAM Act. And that struck me as just a little bit of, you know, both out of both sides of his mouth kind of things. You stand on the border and say, we got it, yada, 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 and then at the same time you've got a deportation hearing out there for somebody who's been a vocal advocate for kids who were brought here as, you know, three-year-olds. Advocating that they be able to get education so that they don't just spend a miserable drudge life of toilet swabbing? It doesn't compute, Andy.
Oh, he's definitely playing the political game on this issue. He definitely got up there, I think, just to show the Hispanic community, wave his hands. I'm still here. I'm still on your side. Although my actions don't show I'm on your side. Don't worry. I'm on your side. Just like he's on the side of working people. No, I'm there for working people. I'm not going to touch the union situation. I'm not going to say anything positive about unions or anything positive about collective bargaining. But believe me, I'm on your side. The guy talks a good game, Bob. You know that by now. He talks a great speech.
Gives a great speech.
They are completely opposite, though.
Gives a great speech.
He does. He is a great speech
giver.
Speaker.
Right.
He's the greatest. And that's why he's there. Because he's a great spokesman.
And, Andy, that's why he's going to stay there. Because he's going to be up again. I mean, right now, what, number one in the polls is Mike Huckabee? Donald Trump has sunk like a stone. Sarah Palin can't get anybody to write about her. Her sort of licentious daughter has a new reality show where she's going to move to Hollywood and live in a flat with two dudes. Really? Who's going to take care of the baby? Don't know. Granny, I guess. Newt Gingrich has declared that he will always love America as long as unless America gets cancer. I'm not going to sit here and say it's a foregone conclusion because I remember when George H.W. Bush lost to an unknown Arkansas governor. But right now, it doesn't look like they even want the presidency. You know, Willard Romney gave his big health care speech today. And it was a real yawn fest. Of course, I can't look at Willard. Pardon?
I heard him talking the other day, and he's going, I don't know why Obama didn't go talk to me before he did his health care plan. He goes, I knew what was good about what was bad about the plan in Massachusetts, you know, which supposedly it's modeled after. He goes, I could have told him what was good and what was bad. He could have consulted with me, but you think he would? Funny.
Of course, I can never look at Magic Underwear Mitt, Andy, without seeing that poor family dog strapped to the top of the automobile howling down the highway on the way to a vacation in Canada. He's the most serious candidate out there. He's the one that's least like a cartoon. But he's also incredibly detached. Do you see?
Here's a guy, I think he's got a Harvard MBA and a Harvard law degree, and he was head of Bain Capital. And I think if you listen to, I think Hartman is in, getting Bain Capital, their main claim to fame is they buy out companies, they make them into they remake them, break the union, break the employees down, and then they resell them.
Right.
Basically, that's what they do. They gut companies and they resell them.
They're predators.
That's where you made it money.
Yeah, it's predatory. And, of course, I guess the big claim to fame for Bain Capital is what, Staples?
Could be.
You know, the office supply superstore.
Is where they got started.
Yeah.
But just take a broken company, break them more. I mean, at least break the unions and break the workers, and then resell them. And make your money and get out and do it again. That's what they do. Just these private equity deals.
But that proves he's a serious businessman, Andy.
Public.
Yeah. But he's serious.
He's a real businessman. He's a real businessman.
He knows how to destroy lives and eliminate the working class. That proves he knows what America needs.
Absolutely. That's just what we need in there. Somebody to bust the middle, a professional at busting the middle class. A pro. And that's what he is. Because that's what they did.
And part of his healthcare discussion today was that, he really knows, what America needs. One of the things that he says.
He knows what ails us, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
He knows what ails us.
He's going to turn Medicare and Medicaid into block grants for the states. And then he's going to let
you. Grants run out. You're dead.
Right.
Die.
Go die. Simple. Go die. Yeah, that's pretty easy.
Good night. You're out of money. Tough.
But then what I found kind of interesting was he's retreading and rebranding and repackaging George W. Bush's idea for privatizing Social Security. Remember how George W. Bush said, "What I want to do is I want to let younger workers be able to put their money somewhere else." Remember that? Well, he's doing. Willard Romney is doing the same thing with health care. He wants to give individuals a choice between the current system and a tax deduction to buy insurance on their own.
That's the Wall Street way.
Yeah.
No, definitely he has Wall Street behind them. But you're right. That is a sorry looking group running against Obama. It really is. It really is a sorry crew. Man.
And you know, if only Jeb Bush didn't have that Hispanic wife, we'd be talking about Obama Bush in 2000, the Obama Bush contest in November 2012.
I think there's still time for him, though, but I'm surprised he didn't throw his hat in, or hasn't so far. I am surprised. I thought that would be the way.
Well, we calculated his age.
It's open seat.
We calculated his age one night, Andy, and the way it looks is that he still has time to run in 16 when he knows he doesn't have to run against Barack Obama.
Right.
He was born 1953. He is exactly 10 years older than me. And so by 16, that means he'd be, 63? That's still plenty presidential.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these guys are, you know, presidents are pampered like show dogs. Look at how they protected Reagan even when he had moved on into the oatmeal dribbling phase.
Well, that was really George H.W. running the show with Nancy running that show that second term, I think.
Yeah.
But it's so hard to beat an incumbent. And like you said, the Republicans know that. Once you've got the incumbent, it's just all the free press, all the free media coverage you're always getting. It's hard to, just hard to unseat somebody with how dumb the American public is. I was always hoping, too, there would be another candidate I could, at least somebody primary to come up. I'm just so kind of upset that that never transpired. Because I'm just afraid, you know, you just mentioned privatizing Social Security, and with the medical situation, too, I have no faith in Obama to do anything good for us. It's just a slow death with Obama. It would be a fast kill if the Republicans got in. You know, they'd go right for the jugular. But with the Democrats, it's just a slow death. It's eventually they come around to doing the same thing the Republicans are going to do. Just takes more time.
And is that Andy? Is that a function of them just being a different manifestation of the same evil, or is that because of the pernicious effect long term of right wing messaging, where we start using their frames? You know, witness as an example of the latter, the fact that, you know, oh, we got to worry about the debt, oh, the deficit, until lo and behold, they've repeated it enough that out in some costs.
Absolutely.
When in fact it's the last damn thing you want to do in an economic meltdown.
Absolutely. They seem to get inundated by the message, and they just give in. They succumb to it. They don't fight back. They reinforce. And that's why I've been so disgusted with Obama. He keeps enforcing the frame that the Republic, he reinforces it. Instead of attacking it, he reinforces it. And like you just said, they give in. And I think it's a function, too, like you said, they're both funded by the same people. The same people on Wall Street are giving, a lot of corporations give 50% to each party. I mean, the numbers show that gets skewed, but, you know, they're playing both sides so the corporations don't lose. So eventually they come around to doing it.
And with that kind of betting, you really can't lose.
Right. They're just paying both sides. God, if there were more parties, they'd have to pay off more parties, but, of course, the ultimate...
But with Citizens United, that's... With Citizens United, that's really not a concern anymore, is it?
Well, it's not an issue because you can do that outside of actually giving directly to the candidate. You can just run your own campaign for the candidate. Right? You just fund that that PAC or that...
Yeah, so as far as the solution goes, you know, the instant runoff voting, we'll use that term for lack of a better one, that coupled with public financing of political campaigns, you might have a chance at getting actual representative government back into the United States, Andy.
Right.
But until that happens,
we're hosed. We're hosed. All right, well, nice topics. I want just to get in that comment about the Manasseh thing. I heard that, and I almost dropped my jaw.
Well, the, you know, the second, I think it was second Manassas, by the way, where some real damage could have been inflicted, except for the fact that the Confederate troops were in such sorry shape, you know, no shoes, barely wearing clothing. They ran them off, and the Northern troops didn't even bother to take their stuff with them. It was a full-scale rout. And instead of chasing them to ground and finishing them off, the Southern forces stopped and, you know, had food. And in a way, that's a great metaphor, and I've mentioned it before, that's a great metaphor for what we do on our side. Instead of running the Republicans to ground when we get a chance to, we stop and didn't we do good? Let's have a little party. Somebody fire up the band.
Right.
Because we didn't finish the job. After we drove Nixon out of office, we could have finished the Republican Party forever.
Correct.
But instead, we stopped to congratulate ourselves for getting that evil, corrupt SOB out of office, and the next thing you know, Ronald Reagan is dirty-tricking Jimmy Carter, and we all know how much crap rolled downhill from that.
Yeah, that is the metaphor. They just don't have the guts. They just don't have the guts to follow through on these things. You know, same thing with Iran-Contra and putting a stop to this kind of garbage and really going after people and just keep on running investigations. They just won't do it. They just don't have the guts. The only time they had the guts was when they actually did the impeachment stuff on Nixon, and that was their last hurrah of the Democrats.
Yeah.
But ever since then, they've never had it in them to bring these criminals to justice. And Nancy Pelosi is one of the biggest ones who, you know, they just want to play along and get along and not make any waves.
And I think Andy, that comes from a fundamental lack of comprehension of the nature of the right-wing soul.
Yeah.
They think they just have a few ideological differences, but we're all Americans and we're all trying to make America better. That's the way liberals think. Right. And nothing could be further from the truth.
Right. They're criminals. They want to kill us. I don't think with this health care stuff, they are killing us. They are wiping us out. They're wiping out Americans.
45,000 dead Americans per year who die because they don't go to the doctor because they can't afford to go to the doctor.
Right. Right. The problem is, I think it's the elites against the elites. And the elite Democrats, the elite liberals just think they have too much to lose. That's why they won't fight. They're afraid they'll lose. And somebody like Nancy Pelosi, who comes from a very, very rich aristocratic background, but she's got a very rich lifestyle, got a very rich husband, you know, in the hundreds of million range. They have too much to lose. It's good life for them. Even a liberal in a Republican regime, it's a good life for them. They're not going to blow that. They just have too much to lose. By sticking it to the Republicans and actually bringing some people to justice and bringing up war crimes, which is what should have been done.
Yeah, I will. You know, that's the thing. By among certain of us, no matter the good that she did as Speaker, and you know, on things like the Employee Free Choice Act and so forth, you know, she held up her end of the bargain. But among certain of us, she will always be remembered for one short sentence. Impeachment is off the table.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the others, they passed a lot of bills, but unfortunately with our Senate, she did a lot of work in the House, but it didn't go anywhere. But my thing is, too, ultimately she lost the Congress. You know, she lost it after a few years. And when you lose like that, shouldn't we be replacing people? Shouldn't we have new people? That's what bugs me. When you fail that grossly and by that kind of margin, shouldn't these Democrat leadership be removed? Instead, we get the retreads and they come back again. That really bugs me, too.
And the thing, you don't even have to be successful. Harry Reid being living proof of that.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. There's a guy that, you know, he totally lacks any kind of backbone and will to fight for working people, anyway.
Well, I just wish I didn't have to be scared to death every time something nasty went before the Senate, just waiting for the Democrats to cave and compromise.
Right.
It's really pretty pitiful. Well, Andy, have yourself a great night, my friend.
All right, Bob. You too. Thanks a lot for the time.
My pleasure. We'll talk to you soon.
Righto.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And are you still there? Yes. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Fancy in Arizona.
Oh, my goodness. Fancy, how are you, dear?
Hi, sweetie.
I was actually thinking of you earlier today.
Susan will appreciate this. There are times I refer to my two granddaughters as Gibney and Cloyd. Remember who Gibney and Cloyd were?
I think you have me at a disadvantage.
Bullwinkle.
Oh.
The Moon Men on Bullwinkle.
Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yes. And I love the Wayback Machine references. I'm a staunch old Bullwinkle fan.
Oh, I love Bullwinkle.
That was such clever things. I once worked with the animator from Bullwinkle.
Really?
A guy named Bob Dalzell. And they produced out of Mexico. They were dodging unions. But who was just kind of dry. He really was not, you'd expect laugh a minute, but he wasn't that bad. Okay, got a few things to cover here. One is I'm looking at a pile of newspaper, well, not a pile, but a short stack, that a friend of mine is cleaning out stuff, and these are saved headlines. So I have Nixon resigns. I have the campus paper, University of Texas. University is segregating the dormitories. I have a number, and we just run out. So if anybody collects old newspapers, please send an email to Bob, who will pass it on to me, and I'll mail these to you. Because there are some newspaper collectors, I imagine, among our group that would...
Oh, I'll bet.
Care that, you know, if you want a few oldies... That are sitting here on my sofa, and I don't know where to put them. I'm one of the things that happens when you get older, you know, you spend your whole life acquiring stuff, and then you hit a point where you say, I gotta get rid of all this stuff. And you start pushing it out. We'll talk about that another time, some of the things I'm sending out, but I do have these historic newspapers. If anybody wants them, send Bob an email, and he'll pass it on to me. I wrote a gag this morning. I got on Stephanie, which I thought was kind of neat.
Oh, yay.
With it. So I'm gonna encore it here. And
do please.
As we've pointed out, Newt, when he discovered his first wife had cancer, he divorced her and married his mistress. And then when his second wife got in MS, he divorced her and married his mistress then. But I think if Calista stays in good health, she has a pretty good chance of keeping him. Shut up. Stay healthy, Calista.
I saw an editorial cartoon of her and Newt over at BartCop today that just made... I appreciate editorial cartooning. I don't laugh out loud a lot at it, but I did it this
one. I send you Fitzsimmons all the time.
Oh, yeah.
One of our local guys that he's just... so on point sometimes.
Well, maybe this was him over, because it was from the Arizona something or other, and it depicts Newt with a big bass drum, with Calista marching along him or beside him, carrying a little briefcase that says adultery, and it's magnificent. But if you want really, really disturbing cartoonery, Maura sent me something earlier today that I've been scouring the interweb tubes trying to find out that this is a hoax, a prank, the Yes Men, something, and I can't find it, Fancy. This is real.
What's happening here?
This is from TPM. Mike Huckabee, the headline, Mike Huckabee Fixes American History. Complete with video. And what it boils down to is, they say, late Wednesday, Huckabee announced LearnOurHistory.com, a sort of BMG music club for what he calls unbiased historical lessons for kids. For about $15 each, the company will send you a new animated tale of American history each month, told through the eyes of a gang of time-traveling kids. And I thought of this when you mentioned, you know, the Wayback Machine.
Uh-huh.
I have an excerpt here. I have a clip. It's only a minute and a half long. And if you can just, if you can stand to sit here and listen to the audio.
Please do.
This kind of has to, okay. You know, it's very modern, hip, sort of animation with the, all the young kid characters have those big, wide-eyed sort of anime look, you know, brat doll kind of thing going on for them. And this is a minute and 21 seconds of the Reagan Revolution. This is remember, this is unbiased history. Okay? One of the best parts of this this piece, Fancy, is the scene in which someone is these kids are walking in D.C. when a person is mugged by a dark-skinned person wearing a disco tank top. Wish I was lying.
Suggestive much?
Yeah, here we go. Gotta love the music, huh?
Addison, you're just in time. I'm almost done with my latest project.
Are you talking about time travel?
Correct.
Journey to a time when America
Next
suffered...
Next stop, Washington, D.C.
The downturn in the economy is killing us. People are out of work, and some of their morals are just gone.
Give me your money.
And in Iran, Islamic fundamentalists stormed the U.S.
Yeah, by the way, the give me your money is the dark-skinned guy with the knife and the disco tank top. Gotta love it. So, here we go.
Embassy and took 52 American diplomats hostage.
Oh, no. It's bad. Really bad.
And danger lurked around every corner.
That guy's got a gun! Come on!
Let's do something!
And learn how one man with some very big ideas set out to
Why
make a huge
so
impact.
Excited?
Can they see hope?
God had a plan for America. I see it as a shining city on a hill. If we ever forget that we are one nation under God, then we will be one nation gone under.
Go back in time to see how one man transformed a nation.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Time Travel Academy, The Reagan Revolution. Okay, time to take the anti-nausea medication, right?
You've got some big money in production on that one.
Oh, yeah, the proto-fascist music and everything?
Yeah, that's not done in the kitchen, on the kitchen table with, two computers and, that's production. Somebody paid.
Yeah.
There's money behind that production. Yeah, I don't know what's going on there.
And they've got more Reagan Revolution. They've got the origins of World War II. This is scary stuff, Fancy.
Yeah, it is scary, and it's okay. I have one other point written down here I want to cover, and it's a whole new thing for me. And I got one of the answers this morning.
Okie doke.
And I'll start by telling the story. My friend who was looking at an advanced birthday and tired of mucking stalls sold the farm and moved to Tucson. And I said, okay, you spent 12 years with a burn pile out there on the farm, and now you're in town, and we recycle, because we're good citizens here in Tucson, and we have these lovely recycling bins. And I took the directions for recycling off my refrigerator and handed them to her. And I said, it's the blue bins you find out on the... And so she took her newspaper, et cetera, out on the street, and there was a blue bin, and she started to put it in. The guy said, you can't do that. That's my recycle bin. I don't want you using my recycle bin. So apparently her place doesn't have a recycle bin.
Oh, dear.
And, okay, so I said, no problem. No problem at all, because Dennis and I share one here, and there shouldn't be any problem. Just bring your newspaper over and put it right in Dennis's recycling bin. So, which she did. And I meet Dennis in the driveway one day, and I said, Dennis, my friend Gail is putting her newspapers in our recycling bin. There's no problem with that, is there? And he said, yeah, there's a problem with that. And I said, excuse me. Knowing it's not a joke, because Dennis virtually has no sense of humor whatsoever. And he said, I don't want the whole neighborhood using, our bin. And I so what had me here I understand selfishness. I understand I need to be first in line. I need to get the biggest piece. That I understand completely. What I do not understand is, we used to call it dog in the manger. You can't eat the hay, but you'll be damned if you let the cow have it either.
Right.
And I don't understand this behavior. And I was telling my lady at my favorite discount grocery this morning, and she said, oh, people are so frightened of everything. And it hadn't hit me of how fearful. And I'm retirement age, you know, and how fearful so many of my contemporaries are. And I just never had enough sense to get frightened. I just took off.
Well, let me ask you a question, Fancy.
Yeah.
Do you think those are members of that generation who always were? Or is it something that has settled upon them in the last 10 years?
I think there is a fear in the country. I'm hearing a don't rock the boatness. I grew up in a time where we were still, who was the guy, go west, young man?
Horatio Alger?
Yeah, I was getting Everett Horton. I'm going, no, that's not it. Yeah, the Horatio Alger, just take off and do it, you know, which I was 20, and I, you know, said, hell, I'm from a little town in Texas. Of course I can live in New York. And I got on a plane and went. And it never occurred to me there'd be a problem. And frankly, there wasn't. Now I did have Daddy to save my butt if I got in trouble, too, which probably...
Yeah, the safety net helps.
I had a good... And I lived in Europe for a while, you know, and I just gypsied around like crazy because it was part of the American adventure of being... of doing what we do. So I don't think it's a factor of my generation that we grew up fearful. But I think there's I couldn't understand why the recycle cans are not your can. They belong to the city. You know.
Right. And you at best have bailment of them.
Oh yeah. I can't understand that I don't want anybody else to use my recycle bin, my recycle can. You know, I don't want anybody else to use my garbage can. That's really dog in the manger shit. It's fully, it's no good to me, but I'd be damned if you can use it. And I don't understand this attitude.
I mean, do they only pick it up like once a month or something? So that, you know, even if one person's using it, it'll just be brimming over with recycling?
Oh, no. First off, they're big. They're like really big garbage cans. And, I live in a little compound. There's 9 of us here, and I think we have 3 of them. And, that's plenty. And they pick it up once a week. So, no, it's not...
But we're paying for this, and we can't have a bunch of slackers who aren't paying, not using our things and getting their recycling taken away for free.
Well, of course, my neighbor he's the one who was telling me, he says, Obama just doesn't understand about the immigrants. Now, we live 60 miles from the Mexican, you know, the border. If I see a Hispanic here, I know that his ancestors have been on this soil longer than mine have. In fact, this guy came from Chicago, so what does he know? But he was telling me...
Yeah, by about 20,000 years?
Yeah. And so this guy's telling me about, you know, he says, Obama just doesn't understand what John McCain. And I said, John McCain, yes on Monday, no on Tuesday, Wednesday, I'm not sure. John McCain, he says, and he stomps off. But I'm wondering, what does this retired gentleman who lives in my compound, what terrible experiences is he having with immigrants? I mean, maybe they're in front of him in the grocery store and he has to wait a minute and they're actually speaking Spanish. But we don't have problems. You know, the rank and file person living here does not have...
You ever press your ear up against his door and listen for Fox News?
I think that may be... Oh God, my girlfriend does. I'm just getting treated to all kinds of good stuff. And a friend of mine had freebies in Las Vegas, and I have kids to visit in Lake Havasu, Gibney and Cloyd. And so I was in Vegas last week, and I'm sitting somewhere having breakfast, and the people at the next table, and I'm at Sam's Town, which is, Sam's Town is kind of your middle class casino. It's, you got a feeling that the people around you came in from small towns in Iowa, you know, for their week of gambling. It's certainly not Caesar's Palace. It's not the high glitz, and I'm pretty comfortable. I don't gamble, so I'm pretty comfortable there. And, I was having breakfast, and the people at the next table were talking about, could you vote if you'd been to prison? And so I kind of, you know, I said, excuse me, different states have different laws about that, and you've got to really consult the state. So then one of the women came to my table and was talking with me, and she says, well, you know, she said, these people were from Ohio, and she said, there was a homeless person who voted 72 times. And I said, why would anybody want to vote 72 times? And she said, oh, they paid him. And I was just thinking, now, if you had to say, mail 72 letters separately in a day, how long would it take you? And if you went to the same post office 72 times, would they notice? Or if you went to each different post office, nobody voted 72 times. And I was thinking how these people are so wedded to the mythology of it's another form of
I think wedded is a really, really good word choice. Because it's some people would say they're heavily invested in. But no, I think wedded to is far more accurate, Fancy, because it's something that exists on a deep, and you know, the people who do the framing, the Frank Luntzes and the Karl Roves and the people like that, they understand the necessity for right-wing messaging to have those little alien-like grappling tentacles that can, you know, get down and really wrap around the viscera.
As I was leaving, and I was taking a banana. I had been to the, you know, the big fancy breakfast, and I can't eat much, so I was taking a banana for later, and one of the guys said, you know, you gonna eat that banana? And I said, well, if you want it, you can have it, sure. Here. And he said, no. He says, you know, did you get your stimulus check? I said, He said, I didn't get my stimulus check. I said, I got something better than stimulus. I've got Social Security. He said, well, I don't get that. He said, I get food stamps, but I spend it on liquor. Now.
Wait, how do you spend? Never mind.
He's obviously joking. And, you know, I can take him apart. And I didn't. You know, I just didn't. And it wasn't even worth the effort to play with it at that point. But this is ha-ha funny. You know, those people spend their WIC money on liquor or and it's just a zeitgeist. And, you know, here these people are. They're well-dressed. I said, where are you from? They were from Ohio. They're well-dressed. They're in a nice hotel in Vegas. You know, they obviously haven't come to go to a church meeting. And they're running this kind of BS. And assuming, since I was well-dressed in the same hotel, that I would find that quite amusing. But it...
I love it when they make those... I love it when they make those assumptions.
Well, you remember on the ship, I was running around with another couple, and we were out, and somebody joined our table, and she was trying to explain to us how wrong we were about our thinking. And I just, you know, I just gave her a hard time, and finally, I probably make more money than you do. Should I pay less taxes? And she said, huh? And I said, well, I make more money than you, and it's the capital gains, so I should pay less, right? And then I said, I've got to go. But, you know, she was telling me, you know, her brother-in-law lost his job, but he did work under the table. And I said, so your brother-in-law is a liar and a cheat. And are your family aware of this? You know, and there's just silence.
As you would, yeah.
Yeah. Or Okay, I'm getting a little red-faced, so we got to stop this conversation. Oh, okay. A friend of mine is starting a museum in our hometown. He actually has an old family home that he's turning into a museum. And I have the brass candles, and it was two candlesticks and a mortar and pestle, and then a junior version of the same thing, a little tea party size version of the same thing, that sat on the mantle in my home in Terrell, Texas. And Jewish families light the Sabbath candles at sundown on Friday. Now, I don't think my family was terribly strict about the sundown part, but I do remember the candles burning. So I said, well, I have those from the family home, and let me put them in the museum. So I opened the box, and oh my goodness, they're black, and Brasso wasn't doing it. So I went online to find out how do you shine brass, and I got to Heloise. Thank you, Heloise. And Heloise had several good suggestions there. One, which worked fairly well, was ketchup. And so I cleaned part of the brass with ketchup, and then another one was a recipe she made with vinegar and salt, and you put flour in it and made a paste. And so I spent 2 days creating my, you remember when you were a kid and Mom's kitchen became sort of a laboratory experiment place?
Yes.
My kitchen was like that over these damn candlesticks. And I finally got them, well, they're relatively presentable. They were given to my grandmother as wedding gifts in 1913. So I guess they're part of my hometown history, and then I wrote a little Provence about it, and I'm going to get that off. But it's kind of nice to have a hometown and people that care and a little sweetness. I'm experiencing a certain amount of sweetness about that.
Indeed. Indeed. Oh, by the way, I've got a question.
Yes.
David in Tennessee wants to know if Gidney and Cloyd have their very own scratch ray like the originals.
I'll tell you what, my Gidney and Cloyd are ages 4 and 7. And the 4-year-old has got a game called Pinkalicious, and you roll the dice and they give you a picture, and then the picture tells you what kind of card, and then the card tells you to hop like a bunny or draw a picture of a whatever, and then you get a cupcake, and you put the cupcake in your little 6-cupcake holder tray, and the first person to get amass 6 cupcakes wins. Now, my friend is going to Vegas to play in a poker tournament, and she's all up for this thing, and we stop in Lake Havasu, and the 4-year-old, we play Pinkalicious with the 4-year-old, who is a hustler. And she says, okay, well, you lose a cupcake. My turn now. My turn. And she, very cute, smiling and beautifully, hustled my friend. And I keep telling my friend, well, because I don't believe it.
This does not bode well for your poker experience. Yeah.
No, what I'm saying is you've used up all your bad luck here on Pinkalicious and cupcakes. So when you get to Vegas, you can have, you know, like money. But it was amazing. Yes, Gibney and Cloyd have whatever little Gibneys and Cloyds have at this point. My daughter's not too charmed with that name, but they were two of my favorite characters ever.
Little heads.
I'll tell you what.
Little onion, little green onion-shaped heads, yeah.
Okay, Bob Del Zell, who was an animator for Bullwinkle, He belonged to the American Nudist Society, and I'd sit there in the office, and I'd sort of look at him fully clothed, and I thought, the last person I would like to see without clothes is Bob Del Zell. It was kind of a thought.
Your mind is a lovely place to hang out.
I told you, when I was a kid, my dad shared a subscription to Sunshine and Health, which was a nudist magazine, black and white. And I said, one of my monthly activities was finding where it was hit this month.
Yeah.
And to this day, I can't watch volleyball without giggling. Yeah, I had a rich childhood. A rich and varied childhood. I'm going to go and let somebody else have a chance at
Well, it's so good to hear from you. You may not believe it, but I was thinking of you earlier today.
Well, I've been listening, but I haven't come to the chat room. I've got the fat black pussycat here who's been very, very needy since I left, and I get to the computer. He gets between me and the keyboard and rests his chin on my wrist. And that's we have bonding, but it sort of cuts down my computer.
Typing time, sure.
Yeah.
It was earlier today when I was looking at the cat. When I thought, and you know, she just had this serene, regal look about her, and I thought of you saying when you related the fact that cat language had in fact been translated, but that it was very boring because it was nothing but everything here is mine.
Everything here is mine, mine.
and that's boring. Yeah. I thought of you in that moment because that was the exact look that was on her face.
I've got one. I'll send you the cat and the guy's holding it. He's got the cat dressed, and the cat has a look. And it said it was a moment of amazing reality when Chester realized that his human was nuttier than a payday, which I had never heard before, but I've been using ever since. I'll send you a copy of that. And if anybody wants these newspapers. There's not a lot of them, but you may want to cull through.
Yeah, just send me an email, and I will forward it on to Fancy, and you guys can work it out from there.
I'm looking at President Richard Nixon resigns, Gerald R. Ford assuming office, and the dorms segregating, dorms integrating, and that's a big deal, and I was in school at that time. I'm not sure why I have some of these, but I will pass them on to if there is a newspaper collector.
Well, you know, there has been some great there's been some great creative work in the UTJ department, and I guess it was in the mid 80s or so, there was a cartoonist there who had a strip, you know, a real live strip that ran called I-Beam. And I-Beam was nothing short of brilliant.
We have a history of cartoonists from the University of Texas. There was Richard Shelton who did the furry Freak Brothers.
Yeah.
And God, I have to look those up. I knew him. I was in school with him. I'm looking right now. I've got Kennedy announces Cuban arms blockade from the Daily Texan.
Oh wow.
I don't know why she said. Oh, I'm now enjoying these ads. I'm looking at a man's suit. With lapels you could put a picnic on.
But probably not candles, because if you did, the thing would go up in flames.
Yeah. Well, this was leisure suit time.
Precisely my point.
And folks is out there. Hugs and hugs. Bye-bye now.
Well, thank you, Fancy. You take care. Good to hear from you. Bye now. 28 minutes past the hour. That's our good buddy Fancy in Arizona. If you ever get a chance to see I-Beam, written and illustrated by Sam Hurt from the University of Texas at Austin, it ran in the Daily Texan from 1980 to 1990, and was nothing short of brilliant. In 1983, the Austin American Statesman picked it up, too. It was genius, because the character... I-Beam, who had a friend named Hank the Hallucination. It follows him all the way through his undergraduate days and up into law school. And was just delightfully funny. I don't know, I wonder what, Sam Hurt is still in Austin, Texas, where he does animation and sculpture. He was brilliant. So it is, there's about 30 minutes left in the program. A little note, I'm not trying to be difficult or anything. We started this program this evening needing 29 contributors to the Thrifty 250, 29 people, $10 apiece. And here with 30 minutes left in the program, we still need 29 people. I don't know what that says. But it's very much a matter of truth. And that's just to sort of catch up and stay even with where we need to be. EYEBEAM, Jug of Punch, I-Beam, EYEBEAM. I don't know if you could find it. I don't know if it's on online or not. Oh, hey, look, there's a website. Thanks, Lottie. There's one strip that I just remember from his law school days where the punchline is, I know he's digging in his book bag and he says, I know I've got my death ray in here somewhere. Oh, a new strip every week? Wow. Ooh, vintage I-Beam? Wow. Okay, I'm saving that website for a little while. I-Beam, EYEBEAM.com. Where to go, where to go, where to go? Jude reminded me of this earlier, and because coal is such a big, poisonous, pernicious part of our lives here in Appalachia, I think I should probably mention this to you. And I should also tell you that as soon as I'm absolutely certain that I can publicize it, I've got an announcement about Netroots Nation coming up in Minneapolis in mid-June. And it's going to be something really, really, really cool. Of course, the Famdamily and I will be driving to Minneapolis. I think we're probably going to leave on... we're going to leave on probably Monday so we can be there on Wednesday, because I ain't driving straight through from here to Minneapolis in one day. Not gonna do it. But it will be a really cool announcement, and I think it's something if you are coming. And I encourage, you know, if you're a member of the Horn family and you can make it to Minneapolis, come on by. Let's have a horn in. A horn in. I like that. If I could figure out some way to put the meat smoker on a trailer in the back of the rental van, by God, I'd take it, and we'd just have a big old barbecue out in the parking lot somewhere. Probably have people gathered together. Then those people certainly do talk strangely, don't they? What are they? I thought hillbillies were imaginary, kind of like, oh, you know, unicorns and elves and leprechauns, but those look like real hillbillies. It would be fun. On this program in the past, I have mentioned something really, really evil and pernicious and wicked that has its roots right here in West Virginia and is like a cancer spreading outward. And that is the... efforts by the Friends of Coal, FOC, they refer to themselves, this is not me being mean to them, they refer to themselves as Fockers. The Friends of Coal, coal-friendly education program, they call it Coal in the Classroom. Several classes have already been subjected to it, classes of children. If it was happening, and my children were involved, I'd be standing on my head in protest. Screaming. But it started here in West Virginia, and now it has gone national. This is a disgusting story out of the New York Times, the education section. Tamar Lewin wrote the story. It was published May the 11th, that being yesterday. Scholastic Incorporated. Remember My Weekly Reader? Ranger Rick, maybe, I think, was another one. That was all done by Scholastic. Well, Scholastic has gotten in, you know, and they seemed always so benign, didn't they? You know, I mean, their name's Scholastic. They're gonna provide materials to your sweet little children where they can do some edumacating and learning and so forth and ciphering and gazettas, right? It's those benign sounding names that wind up doing the most evil. Scholastic was paid by and therefore got in bed with the American Coal Foundation. The American Coal Foundation. Jude sent this along, and it's hair-raising. The American Coal Foundation has a website that is not a joke. Visit the United States of Energy at Scholastic. It's right there on the main page. The United States of Energy. Grade 4 lessons, activities, and printables. That's what this story is about over at the New York Times. Scholastic's in-school marketing division, which produced the coal curriculum in partnership with the Coal Foundation, they're literally putting this out for the entire country because they can't play on a level playing field. They have to tilt it. They have to have some advantage, and they are not above poisoning the minds of fourth grade children in the same way and perhaps as much as they poison the bodies of those same fourth grade children. This is sleazy and slimy. It comes from Scholastic's in-school marketing division. The division's programs are designed to promote client objectives and meet the needs of target teachers, students, and parents, and make a difference by influencing attitudes and behaviors. 26,000, conservatively estimated. The number is probably considerably higher. 26,000 Americans will die this year directly because of the filth and the poison that coal-fired power plants pump into our air. It is statistically likely that of those 26,000, some, one, maybe two, maybe 100, will be fourth graders whom Scholastic has told, coal is your friend. Thank heaven for activist groups. Thank goodness for Rethinking Schools, the campaign for a commercial-free childhood, and Friends of the Earth. Because they're pointing out and raising a ruckus about the fact that this is a shameless piece of propaganda garbage that says nothing about how poisonous coal is for people. Welcome to the United States of Energy. This educational program brought to you by the American Coal Foundation and Scholastic teaches about the variety of energy sources that are being used across the United States to power homes and businesses. Well, hello, children. Welcome to the neighborhood. Let's go over here past the castle of King Friday the 13th and see King Friday the 13th's coal-fired power plant. Oh, look at King Friday the 13th's little subjects dying because they can no longer breathe because they work in King Friday the 13th's coal mines. Lesson plans, printables, resource links, family activity, really, family activity. Bonus! Family resource sheet. Encourage families to get involved in their children's learning with these family materials for the United States of Energy. Family activity, the energy challenge. We all know that it's good to turn off the lights and appliances when they're not needed, but now we can illustrate the importance of conservation. Using less energy saves money. As a family, visit the Coal Energy Cost Calculator. Fill in the blanks while discussing your normal household behavior. Then hit Calculate and see how your everyday activities translate into money spent on electricity. The watts and dollars really add up, don't they? Jesus. Well, let's see. What else do we have? Lesson 1, Our Energy. Lesson 2, Mapping Electricity. Guide your students on a tour across the country as they practice their internet research and map reading skills to discover the different sources of energy used to create electricity in different states. And look at mountains, mountains blown away, 500 mountains gone, 1,000 streams buried by happy Mr. Coal Lump. And let's use our Google Earth and drill down just a little bit further, and maybe we can see some children choking to death. You understand why it's a constant uphill struggle against these merciless, rapacious, remorseless bastards? I suspect Mike Malloy will have more to say about this evening, so I'm not going to beat on it too much. You can get the link to the story over at his main page. And many thanks for the individual and who just kicked in 10 slots in the Thrifty 250. Thank you. Now we only need 19. That was much and badly needed. The bills are waiting to be paid. 19 minutes before the hour, and we go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob Kincaid, it's Mark down in Florida.
Hey, Mark, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, Bob. Sorry about my language the other night on your show.
Don't sweat it. Don't sweat it.
I think you understood my frustration, and it wasn't done in a calculated way. I've never been a person to strike another person. I'm more of a Harry Truman, the buck stops here kind of human, by the way.
Understood, and I think everyone understood the tenor and meaning of what you said. I think no apologies are in order.
I also, in my emotional outburst, I also used the name. I talked about Joint Special Operations Command. The right wing is trying to make it sound like they've been around only since George Bush Jr. He probably still has never heard of them, but. Actually, they were created. I made the mistake, Bob, of saying it was Elliot Abrams, which I meant to say General Creighton Abrams. So
right.
Just to check my own facts, Bob, I know I sent you an email concerning that issue, but I wanted to let the listeners know that I was bright enough to know the difference about Creighton Abrams compared to Elliot Abrams. And
well, I figured you'd be calling back, so I wanted to let you do that, take care of that yourself.
Well, I appreciate it, Bob. And I have been trying to call you earlier, and I leave earlier for work. It's about a 90-mile round trip each day. So, but in any case, one thing about Creighton Abrams, I got on the internet just to check my facts to make sure that I had my ducks in a row. And he made some. He was kind of like a modern day Truman attitude about the corporatization of our military, which. Standing opposed to the Blackwaters and the X's and the whatever they're called, and it's more the strength of Raytheon and Martin Marietta and Sikorsky and those folks. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then another person I read about a general that worked for Kennedy named David M. Shoup, a Medal of Honor winner from I believe Guadalcanal. As a young lieutenant, worked for Smedley Butler, who worked for David Rockefeller in China, as we young Marines are taught about some kind of insurrection and Boxer Rebellion. It's probably about the Chinese trying to keep their own resources for themselves, and they send in the Marines on the behalf of the Rockefellers to do that. But Butler writes the book, I think it's been mentioned on your show, War is a Racket. Ironically, David M. Shoup worked for Smedley Butler, and of course Smedley Butler they tried to fool him into overthrowing Franklin Delano Roosevelt's government, actually,
right,
with the use of disgruntled bonus army veterans. I wanted to say one thing about your coal comparison and how they were leaking that type of information to us. You and I are in a similar age group, so we're reading the same type of sick propaganda. It's real subtle. There's another thing that they've done to us, amongst many, I'm sure, but was the argument about Social Security. And you listen to any kid that's under 40 And they just all repeat that same line. We never expected it to be there. And so on their Dollar General, Dollar Tree, Yum Yum Tree, Checks Cashed Here Society, you know, flea market, driven and considering, Walmart an upgrade future, I don't know how they plan to pay for their, futures, which they won't have one. I'm being sarcastic, and it's a really a sad commentary, but they have leaked that back, prior to the glorious Ronald Reagan or sometime in that frame. I know that they examine that stuff in society.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the willingness, you know, whether it's coal in the classroom or this other vile, pernicious thing that's being hustled by Mike Huckabee, this wholesale rewrite of history that I mentioned in the course of conversation with Fancy. On the one hand, Mark, it's real easy to look at it and say, ha ha, look at that, these dummies are lying about it. But then you stop and you think, wait a minute, they're doing this to children. They are, I mean, this is worse than the Santa Claus or Easter Bunny or Tooth Fairy myth.
That's correct.
This is overt, deliberate lying about real facts that children need to be able to get through the world. History is not an anachronism. History is not an abstraction. History is how you get to where you are. And if you don't know where you came from, you don't know where you are.
That's the difference between a massy mind and a non-massy mind worker. It's the difference between, you know, minimum wage and not even knowing what minimum wage or and it's he also works with that false historian, the guy that gets about 90% of things right. I had a situation at work I thought you might find interesting. It's rather subtle. But there's an iron worker on our job at the nuclear power plant that's only been in the United States about 10 years, Bob. And his English is quite perfect, though. It's heavily accented. And after working with him for a few months, one of his coworkers shared with me that he's actually a veteran from the military. And I watched him walk. He's not very social. And I'll get to the point of the observation with him, but I watched how he walks, and I watched him make like a turning movement. You know, having been a Marine, we're very good at marching, and we know how to see that in other humans if we care to look. And he had the professional soldier's move. I asked him, Bob, I thought you might find this interesting, because I've heard he sits and reads the Bible and stuff. And I sat down next to him one night, and because I'm a polite person, and people come up and talk to me and think that I am listening to them, but I'm only being polite because I do have my set values. But he said, which are democratic, and I asked him, I said, do you think America should be do you believe a separation in church and state? And he hesitated, and I thought, well, that's odd. He's hesitating not because of the English, the way I speak. And then I said, well, I'll be polite and get a little more aggressive. And then I said, well, do you think America should be a theocracy? And that same hesitation, he knew exactly what I was saying. And he's only been in the country 10 years. He's in his early 40s. And that's a very scary proposal to me, to have people, when you've got Mike Lyerby rewriting fake history, and then you take these immigrants from the Ukraine or from wherever in the hell they are with all their religious, they're way more plowable and pliable. And it's a very scary proposal there, I thought.
Well, it is, and when you understand the pernicious, that word keeps coming up tonight, impact of these fundamentalists on countries like Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, you know, when you look at the effect of fundamentalism in the Latino population, you know, everybody tends to think of them as sort of monolithically Roman Catholic, but that's not true. I mean, I remember a story a few years ago about these fundamentalists who were literally dropping hand crank radios via parachute into unreachable areas of Mexico, and the only thing that they would bring in was Jesus broadcasts and Jesus news and, you know, right-wing fundamentalist views of the world. That's terrifying. Look at the fundamentalist influence in Uganda. Our Jude sent me a piece earlier today about certain each other in Uganda, and the driving force behind all of that is nothing but dirty, sleazy, right-wing, fundamentalist, so-called Christianity in the United States that has succeeded in pumping literally millions of dollars in the campaign into the Ugandan campaign to kill Ugandans for being gay.
That's correct. And here are the same folks that tie in to Wall Street through a backhanded method that support that kind of nonsense. Those are the folks. I think it's the Liberty Church I was just reading. They want to paint NPR to be the big frickin' frack. Also a fan of Bullwinkle, like all the other callers and yourself. But NPR only receives about 20% of our out of their funding from the taxpayers, whereas Liberty University receives $500 million a year, and they get NPR gets 238, and it's all with corporate interests. I even here in Central Florida, Bob, or in my travails like around Orlando and stuff, I'll see young Latino folks with the long skirts, and they're not from Oaxaca. They're from, they may be from Oaxaca, but those are long skirts because those are Caucasian long skirts. It's really fundamental. I was in El Torreo, it's a popular chain here in Ocala, and I realized I was having a conversation with somebody who I thought was Latin, and she started using that nonsense no platform mentality, and I thought they're not coming from anywhere. I said, do you even know? I mean, do you even know who Zapata? I spray painted Abraham Lincoln on a Confederate statue, and Martin Luther King right below it, and JFK, and I got arrested doing it, and I paid my fine, it was a black and white policeman, and I thought it was hilarious, by the way, when you said the Yankees ran at Manassas. I'm sure that they did, and more than once, I'm sure, having spent a lot of my adult life in the South, but I thought that was hilarious, and I'm familiar with Chamberlain. But the black cop says, well, what did you do that for? And I said, well, aren't you black? I said, don't you understand what that is? He seemed so redneckerized, so Caucasianized. He actually didn't, Bob. He was only in his 30s. Now, and then as I stood before the Cuban Republican judge, she said, is there anything you want to say to the courtroom? And, And I said, well, yes, ma'am. I said, had slavery continued, would you have been an immigrant to the United States? I mean, this is a quintessential question. That's why I spray painted Abraham Lincoln on there. And I just thought, it's they're very spooky with that religious fundamentalism. And you're right about that monolithic that they are not. And that's important. That I don't know. It's but anyway, Bob, I just wanted to apologize to you. I am
no need
by President Obama, and as you are, but I think it's our only current temporary hope, and it's just like we're all hanging on by our fingernails. But the Koch brothers are sure going to continue to do well. And
they're doing past well. You're there in Florida, and
right.
I'm sure you've seen the story about the economics department that the Koch brothers have bought themselves at Florida State. Now, me, I think about Florida State, and I immediately think about football and Bobby Bowden and all of that business and Free Shoe U and whatever.
Right.
But the Koch brothers bought themselves an economics department there and insisted in the fine print on the right to declare who may be hired and who will not be hired. Absolute ideological control of the curriculum. Now, you take that and you couple it with things like the coal education program, you couple it with these phony baloney revisionist histories being hustled by Mike Huckabee, and you really do begin to get a sort of a mosaic of the image of the America that these people intend to create. And it goes back to that stuff, again, referring to our dear friend Jude, that she sent about the Dominionists wanting to, what they call, reclaim seven mountains. And one of those seven mountains is education. They intend to completely control it, Mark. And if it, and for anyone paying attention, it should scare people senseless. But, you know, good luck getting the for-profit media to report on it.
Well, what's left of that, you know, that's all been so, you know, the privatization of education, you can see with what you just said, this is top-down, bottom-up, and they're coming from the side. And that's how it all ties in with FCAT, the closing of schools after your test scores don't measure up. They had the microcosm use of that in Texas, then they brought it here, just like how they stole the election. They tried it there in Texas and fine-tuned it, and they brought the program here to steal the national election. Same tactics they did what they're doing with FCAT, which is actually being driven by a private corporation called Ignite, owned by Neil Bush after the, of course, the Silverado savings and loan, and, of course, the one-woman caller with the nice voice, John McCain's association with that, and the Bush family, and that, you know, they're privatizing, and they're working hand in hand, coming in from the side. They're going to close schools, and they're going to charge these Dollar General, Walmart future Americans that make, if they're lucky, $9 or $10 an hour to send their children to what used to be a public school. And sorry about no health care, because we're doing the same things to hospitals. This is a successful business strategy of closing and marketing and driving up the prices for anything that used to be called.
It is the wholesale marketization of everything. Literally, you know, it's like I said at the beginning of the program, Mark. Let's just all get it. Let's get all the brand names tattooed on our hides. Never mind the suits and patches. We have been, from the soles of our feet to the tops of the ends of the hair on our heads, we have been monetized and capitalized and profitized. And there's nowhere to go to escape it.
And if you complain loud enough, Bob, you'll go before one of their corporate judges. It'll be a General Electric judge or a Weyerhaeuser or a Georgia Pacific judge. It's basically the straw boss. It's going back to the company store. It's really a company much more corporatized and much more less communal or community oriented. Not that that was ever righteous, but you know what I'm saying.
I do. And Mark, I have to run along, but do dial back in, okay?
Yep.
I love our conversations.
Same here, Bob.
Take care.
God bless.
You too. Bye now. Mark in Florida. And it's time to get out of here. Thank you very much for cutting that from 29 to 19. It was much appreciated, and like I said, badly needed. Bills are waiting for payment. I hate those emails. You know, dear deadbeat. no, they don't begin that way. But it is time to get out of here. Rick Smith is next. And if you've never listened to Rick, you need to give him a shot sometime. Just catch the podcast over at White Rose Society. Anyway, Rick is among the best. Certainly, without a doubt. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. From Lottie in the chat room to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to Texas Betsy as she gets better and better, to our op-ed columnist, Reverbo, Cavalcade of Crazy, head on RadioNetwork.com. The fourth installment of Looking for Work in a Cavalcade of Crazy is up and deserves your attention. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer, webmaster, web designer, show host in his own right, and we'll be back someday. And thanks to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org, who makes all of the streaming happen here. Without Ben, there's no horn. Thanks, of course, to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.